listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, an update of news and events from the Central and South America and Caribbean region with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua. Let's start. The big news, apparently, is this coming Sunday, the presidential and the legislative elections in Mexico.
Yeah, and it, all the signs are that Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who most people locally in the region refer to as AMLO, all the signs are that AMLO is going to win. He has something like 52% of voter preferences in the latest polls. And the opposition are so worried about it that they're talking about trying to strike up an alliance between the two main right-wing candidates. But it's very unlikely that, who knows? Given the record of Mexico's electoral system, almost anything is possible, because AMLO, López Obrador, he should have won in 2006.
Right.
And then he should have won in the subsequent election. But every time it's been stolen from him. But this time, because the situation in Mexico is so dire economically for most people, and there's a lot of resentment against the elites that's kind of curiously associated with the immigration policies of Donald Trump. And even though the Mexican elites have kind of made bleating noises about, how much they object to U.S. immigration policy against people crossing into the United States from Mexico, both Mexicans and migrants from Central America, they are very much associated with the United States government because of their economic policies over the last 10, 15, 20 years, ever since the introduction of the North American Free Trade Agreement, which for Mexico's agricultural sector was a disaster.
Right. I mean, you have this dynamic going on in the U.S., for example, where the whole conversation about immigration from Central America in particular is completely devoid of the context. The context being the economic devastation of NAFTA to the agricultural sector in Mexico, and B, the role of the United States with the various coups and the other ways of maintaining governments that have death squads basically terrorizing the people, driving people out of their homes because they're running because people are shooting at them at their backs. Nobody's discussing that. And the governments, of course, that implement these policies for the United States are not going to be bringing those policies up either.
No, right. So I'm the Andrés Manuel López Obrador and has been able to take advantage of that deep resentment among people in Mexico against the political establishment there, represented by the current president, Peña Nieto, and the previous president, people like Felipe Calderón and so forth. And it looks as though he's on a roll. And now, will he win? By all rights, he should. But the Mexican electoral system is notorious for its corruption. Who knows what the... Although at a national level, its officials may be in good faith, at a lower level, down around the country, mid and lower level officials in the electoral system are just as subject to intimidation from organized crime, from intimidation by political operators, and corruption as well from both those sources.
Right.
It's impossible to say what the electoral result will finally be, although...
Well, let's talk about intimidation. I mean, the kind of intimidation we're talking about is they murder people. I mean,
over 120 candidates have been murdered in the electoral process in Mexico since that electoral process. A very complicated one, it has to be said, since it began in last September.
Yeah.
Because it's not just presidential elections, it's legislative, municipal,
yeah,
and a whole series of state elections, a whole series of elections happening all at once. So it's a very complicated electoral process, and that might contribute to confusion. To the extent that López Obrador may well win the election, but lose the count. That's the cliche, isn't it? People win the election, but lose the count.
Right, that's right. So that's the they attribute that to Stalin, right? It's whoever counts the votes is the one that matters.
Right. So let's be optimistic. Let's say that Andrés Manuel López Obrador wins the election and succeeds, survives, he's not murdered or assassinated before he actually is inaugurated as president in Mexico. And what are his policies likely to be? And I don't think we should expect any very radical changes in Mexican foreign policy. Mexican domestic policy is likely to be much more subject to reform and change under Andrés Manuel López Obrador than Mexican foreign policy, because Mexican foreign policy already is geared more towards developing relations with China and with the Asian Pacific countries, all the countries of ASEAN, for example, than it is towards consolidating its relationships with the United States. And also Mexico is trying to develop better relations and trade relations with the European Union.
Yes.
So, that kind of foreign policy trend in Mexican foreign policy is likely to be deepened and consolidated under Andrés Manuel López Obrador, but it's one that was already in train.
Right.
And so the other area of foreign policy where López Obrador is likely to be more belligerent than Peña Nieto is what we were discussing earlier about Mexico's view of U.S. immigration policy.
Right.
And so López Obrador is likely to be much more aggressive defending the interests of Mexican people migrating to the United States and the interests of Mexican people already in the United States, who for one reason or another haven't been able to legalize their status within the United States. So
it's a much better, it's a much easier road to hoe, so to speak, if you are, defending your people's rights in the United States or to go to the United States when they're not going there because you're shooting at them. And right. So a change in administration, if we see López Obrador and Morena take power, and I'd like to discuss that too, because we've got the Chamber of Deputies election, the legislative right. election, and we got to see how they're going to play out. And they are in an alliance, at least for that far, with the Socialist Labor Party, the PT, and also a right-wing, sort of an evangelical party, the PES.
Right. Yeah, I'm not by any means an expert on Mexico's electoral politics, but obviously López Obrador's ability to implement changes in Mexican domestic policy is going to depend on how strong his representation is and his alliances are in Mexico's legislature. And so that's a whole other story, isn't it? But the two areas where López Obrador is likely to try and make most impact is in terms of Mexican agriculture, trying to defend what's left of right. Mexico's agriculture that historically has always been based on small and medium-sized family farms, right? And so that's one area where he's likely to try and do things to in the interests of people at grassroots in Mexico. And the other, of course, is corruption. He's likely to, to the extent that he can, tackle the chronic corruption in Mexico's public life.
Yeah.
What he's going to be able to do in terms of security, trying to roll back the presence of organized crime in Mexico is anybody's guess. I mean, he's likely not to be able to do much at all in that area. But those are areas that he has mentioned as things that he'll work to try and address.
When you have a condition of precariousness or desperation on behalf of the people, then organized crime, flourishes, thrives in that kind of an environment. Then if you can start unpacking that problem, then perhaps, maybe it's a longer trajectory to get to the point of being able to, make irrelevant or certainly tamp down, weigh down the role of these, like, narco-terror gangs, mafia types and such in the public life. But now, people are afraid to even stand up and speak because there'll be a sense. Again, 120 some
over 120.
People. Yeah, candidates murdered.
Yeah, candidates. You're not talking about ordinary people, activists or campaigners. You're talking about candidates.
I mean, I'm thinking about what it's like to get on the ballot in the United States, for example, where you have people that have to go door to door, knocking on doors, and ask the people who answer to sign a petition to get this candidate or that candidate on the ballot. If there is a mafia that runs everything in the neighborhood and they kill people who oppose them, unless you know which doors to knock on, that's a really formidable task just at the basis sure. of the electoral system.
Oh, yeah, sure. And you can bet your life that local people are well aware of what doors to knock on and which doors to leave alone.
You have to be 100% correct, though.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, but that level of chaos, going back to what you were saying earlier, Don, about what are the reasons, what are the root causes of migration from Mexico and Central America to the United States? And what the United States has done over the years, its very policies, as other writers have pointed out in relation to Europe, its very policies the policies of the foreign policies of the United States government over many decades have created this migration because they deliberately set out to destabilize not just countries but whole regions.
Right.
And you can see that at work here in Nicaragua now. And I don't know, should we move on to talk a little bit about Nicaragua?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've been talking about it for a couple of weeks, and now it seems that maybe there might be some air coming out of that little problem. So, yeah, let's definitely update what's going on.
Yeah, and what happened in Nicaragua was that legitimate peaceful protests back in mid-April were immediately hijacked within 24 hours. Were hijacked by violent extremists whose agenda was to overthrow the government. Now, and the government response to that has been to avoid broad civil conflict, accept a certain level of violence, withdraw the police from the streets in response to opposition demands mediated by right-wing Catholic church bishops, so as to, as a kind of guarantee allow the protesters to develop their agenda, which they did extremely violently. But as time has gone on, the level of popular support for the extremist opposition who are demanding the overthrow of the government has completely fallen away, to the extent where here in Esteli, where I live, and the opposition have made two or three calls for protest marches over the last week, 10 days, and they've had to cancel them because nobody turned up.
Good, yeah.
So the level of popular support for the opposition agenda has completely faded away. And if they could certainly probably organize a big demonstration in Managua, but only by busing in people from the rest of the country. So what are their demands now? Their demands are no longer let's have the overthrow of the government. Their demands are let's bring forward elections. And one of the reasons that they've kind of moderated their demands, or at least the people that are engaged in the public national dialogue have moderated their demands, is because in the Organization of American States, Nicaragua's very astute and very experienced diplomats have managed to work with the Organization of American States in such a way as to diffuse the false reports about human rights abuses and so on. And they've been working with the Organization of American States since 2016 on an agenda of reforming the electoral system. And that's completely diffused attempts, so far anyway, attempts by the United States government and right-wing politicians like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, for example, to try and get measures approved in the Organization of American States condemning the Nicaraguan government. They've completely failed to do that.
Okay.
So, but what does that mean? That means that because they're working with the Organization of American States and they've agreed an agenda for reform of the electoral system, the likelihood of elections being currently scheduled for 2021 being brought forward into 2019 next year, that are very slim. And if elections are brought forward, I think the earliest that they're likely to happen now is 2020. And let's see. But the key thing is the extremist Nicaraguan opposition are now very much on the defensive, certainly domestically, because everybody's sick of them.
Yeah.
And they've destroyed the tourist industry with their violent attacks on infrastructure and their roadblocks, their intimidation over the last 2 months. They've thrown tens of thousands of people into unemployment. You know, there's a strong feeling at grassroots here that people do not want any more economic damage as a result of the opposition strategy of extreme violence, attacking government infrastructure, And apart from that, there's also a deep outrage among a lot of the Nicaraguan population at the importation into Nicaragua of sadistic practices like torture and executions that are characteristic of El Salvador and Honduras and organized crime there and the so-called Maras there. And those, that has appeared. And you've had health workers, municipal workers being kidnapped and tortured publicly on the barricades. That the, you know, what great public relations, right?
I mean, why did they get rid of Somoza in the first place if they were going to go back to those policies?
Well, even because you have to remember that you're talking about a very extremist minority.
Right. The
mainstream right-wing opposition are increasingly trying to put distance between themselves and the extremists because they realize that their activities have been completely counterproductive in terms of rallying support for the opposition demands.
That's an interesting dynamic that you always have to watch, too, when you have these kinds of operations. For example, you had the hard right, the Nazis, literally, in Ukraine, that played the same role in the upheaval there. And the government's response did not lead to there wasn't enough breathing space for people to understand what was happening until they started to see, that kind of behavior. At that point, the government was gone. Here, you have a collective memory of Somoza and also a collective memory of the lost decades of the U.S.-Contra War. You know, you talk about people losing the tourist season. You had a decade or so where, people were not going to Nicaragua for tourist season unless they were, going to be conscripted into somebody's military and shoot at Sandinistas. There's been a very, productive period and a good one for most people in the country since the first election of Daniel Ortega. And I think a lot of people are reluctant to go back to the kind of instability that existed prior to that. And that is something that you didn't have in Ukraine and some other places.
Right. No, I've been very critical of the government for not cracking down right from the start, because whatever they did, they were going to get condemned. It wouldn't have mattered if they'd... And look what happened in Honduras after just a week of protests following the elections there last time.
Right.
They put the army on the street. They declared a curfew. Everybody had to be indoors by 9 o'clock at night. Anybody out on the streets could have been shot.
Right.
Right. That's what happened in Honduras. And where was the outcry then?
Well, where was, it's a longer term game.
Where was the international media then? They couldn't care less.
Agreed with all of that. But in terms of actual policy, long term, that those actions in Honduras are producing what's going to come next, which is at some point people will rise up against what's there. If Nicaragua's government did that, there would also be some long-term, seething anger over it that would be, cooking out in the population waiting for the next moment like we had in April. That might drive things further. And so acting with moderation... with these color revolutions in a can that come out of Washington or whatever, isn't necessarily the mistake it appears. It may be a mistake. I mean, you have to look at from situation to situation and, a number of conditions that exist at the moment in each of these places. But I understand and acknowledge that there's value in doing what Ortega and the Sandinistas did.
Oh, yeah, and there are strong arguments for what he's done. But one fundamental thing you have to remember is that in Honduras, the repression was against Democrats.
Right.
Here you're dealing with fascists.
Right.
You're dealing with people who kidnap ordinary workers and torture them.
Yeah.
But and so
among
you're dealing with people. You're dealing with people who yesterday... a policewoman was working with municipal workers clearing one of the barricades. The opposition thugs murdered her. They shot her.
Right.
Shot her dead.
I understand part of it.
So...
When you crack down on the fascists, though, you also are cracking down often on people who were fooled by the fascists, who happen to be standing next to them at the moment or whatever. And that's the part that's that is a look. Yeah. Like I said, who knows? But
and that is the argument of the administration here. President Ortega has argued that we have to avoid bloodshed. We have to accept a certain level of casualties and destruction, because otherwise we run the risk of heading into an all-out civil war. And
right.
A lot of people think that he's right, but when you look at the deaths and the terrible hardship and suffering that's been imposed by the extreme right-wing opposition here, you have to wonder.
I understand the impulse too, to want to go, yourself, to like want to grab a gun basically and go out and get some get back for it, get some justice.
Right. So then, but that, and putting that back in the context of what we were talking about in relation to Mexico, and all those policies, and the United, and a guy called Max Blumenthal, who's supposed to be some hotshot reporter on the progressive side of political opinion in the United States, he wrote an article recently explaining how the U.S. government openly boasts about having laid the groundwork for the insurrection here. Now, that's another example of what United States, what you were talking about earlier, of how United States policy has actually fomented instability and destabilized whole societies. And that is what has led to the whole migration issue in the United States.
Right.
And you can see that from kind of one country to another. If you look at Argentina, for example, Argentina is a member of the G20. It's one of the most advanced economies in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at what's happening in Argentina, that we've discussed on various occasions over the last couple of years, and Mauricio Macri, the right-wing president there, came to power on a promise of bringing new prosperity and promoting investment and all the rest of the neoliberal claptrap that these right-wingers always come out with. And anybody who saw that result was immediately able to say, right, well, within 2 years, the Argentinian economy will be in the toilet. And it is.
Here we go. I mean, we're going back. It's December 5th, 2001. Okay, they're about 2.5-3 years into the huge economic collapse that they had in Argentina, with the last group of looters that had control of the government, the Macris of their day. And the IMF decides, we're not going to release a $1.3 billion tranche of a loan that we've been using to essentially tighten our grip on your country. And that caused an absolute collapse of almost every institution in the society. And after that, you get Nestor, and the economy gets turned around, and then Cristina, and the economy continues to turn around. And then in December of 2015, you get Macri, and here we are, back to the IMF.
Yeah, and the IMF is now the body that decides economic policy in Argentina. And if you're a public worker in the public sector in Argentina, over the last 2 years, your salary has lost 21% of its value. That explains. I think it was yesterday or today. The labor unions in Argentina called a third general strike, and very successful strikes by all accounts, to the point where even Mauricio Macri is calling for national dialogue. Macri is this kind of gung-ho right winger who imposed his policies against the wishes of most people in Argentina, but he was able to gain the configuration of power in the country's National Assembly, in the lower house and in the Senate, to get his way. And so he imposed those policies, including massive price hikes in fundamental things like the gas price, which is very important in a country like Argentina.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the figures that I saw was that the prices increased by 4,000%.
And you had massive layoffs in the public sector. You had a return to the day of the corporate domination of the media, so that the public discussion of the things that were happening around people changed from one involving the public to one directed at the public. And now he's asking to have a public dialogue where he has the microphone, and the problems that they're going to talk about are things that he helped engineer. It's a pretty interesting dynamic.
Which he can't change anyway, because he's no longer calling the economic shots. It's the IMF
that's
going to decide what happens.
And
all the signs are that Argentina's heading back, as you pointed out, to the worst days of the crisis that it had to confront back in at the very start of the new century.
Mm-hmm. And we've got like two more minutes, so I'd like to just make a quick reference to Evo Morales's trip to China last week.
Yeah, I know there are a couple of things there, aren't there? I mean, he had a very successful visit to China, and in which President Xi stated that China and Bolivia's relations were now at a new strategic level. Mm-hmm. And that he was obviously referring to the inauguration over the next year or so of the transcontinental railway that will start from the port of Hilo on Peru's southern Pacific coast, travel through Bolivia, and then across to Brazil's port of Santos on Brazil's southern Atlantic coast. Mm. So, and that is going to be a real game changer in terms of South America's continental economy, and then it explains a lot about why even right wing governments in the region are paying more attention to their relations with China now than they're paying to their traditional relations with the United States.
We're going to have to come back to this next week, Tony. I appreciate your time, as always, and we'll speak with you then.
Okay, thanks a million, Don. Look forward to it.
The same. Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The fruit of the poisonous tree. This is what critics are calling the ongoing investigation of alleged Trump world collusion with Russia during the 2016 election. In the meantime, the upper echelons of the FBI have been decimated over proven misconduct. Has Russiagate morphed into FBI gate? Crosstalking Investigations, I'm joined by my guest, Doug Weed in Washington. He's a presidential historian and a former White House advisor to two American presidents. Also in Washington, we have Richard Goodstein. He is a Democratic political strategist and former advisor to Hillary Clinton's two presidential campaigns. And in New York, we have Lionel. He is a legal analyst and a news decoder at LionelMedia.com. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Lionel, let me go to you first in New York. I don't usually read the Wall Street Journal, but I did come across a fascinating op-ed a few days ago. Mueller's fruit of the poisonous tree. It makes no difference how honorable he is. His investigation is tainted by the bias that attended its origin in 2016. Is this investigation the result of a poisonous tree? Go ahead, Lionel. And you're a legal analyst, so go ahead.
Indeed, the doctrine of the fruit of the poisonous tree is applicable. And also keep in mind where all of this started from was Hillary Clinton trying to explain to the world how she lost a rigged election. Everything that followed, all of the derivative analyses, all of the investigations, all became relevant because of that initial attempt on her part to explain either how she lost or how the Russians were somehow involved in it. And then as it evolved, The American people understand there are biases. It's okay for an FBI agent to have a political inclination. That's one thing. But this makes Watergate look like a walk in the park. It is contaminated. It is ochreous, olid. It's rank, feculent, and it's all there for our viewing pleasure.
Okay, Richard, it's really obvious. I'll give you the opposing position. Go ahead, my friend.
So I read that Wall Street Journal piece that you refer to, which I frankly, Peter, saw as twisted, bordering on the deranged for this reason. If Peter Strzok was single-handedly out to keep Donald Trump from being president, he knew everything about the counterintelligence investigation of Donald Trump. He knew that Don Jr. and the rest of the crew met with the Russians in Trump Tower. He knew that Papadopoulos had met with, you know, had bragged to the Australian ambassador about the dope, the dirt on Hillary. He knew about Felix Sater trying to get a Trump Tower Moscow built. He knew that there was fake, there were lies put out about that Trump Tower meeting. And yet, he did nothing to disclose to the public that this counterintelligence investigation was going on before Donald Trump got elected. And at the same time, he encouraged Comey to put out that letter that was so damaging 10 days before the campaign was over. That was Strzok's doing. So to me, this notion that the fruit of the poisonous tree is twisted. It is perverse. And as I said, I think kind of deranged, and it speaks to how people want to kind of see ghosts. You know, Donald Trump refers to this as a witch hunt. The phrase witch hunt became because there were no witches. Mueller's gotten 5 plea agreements. He's gotten another dozen or more people indicted. These are not witches. These are real humans who have pled guilty to crimes. So sorry if somehow or
To be honest here, all of these crimes have nothing to do with Russia, number one, okay? At least the Russian government here. Let me go to Doug. I want to agree with Lionel and Richard here, because Richard said something that's very interesting. You see what you want in this. Both sides see exactly what they want. And we've been watching this go on for 2 years. But, Doug, I think one of the things that I would contest with Richard is that we don't really know when this counterintelligence operation started, because the players that are involved keep changing their story. OK, it was supposed to be July. Now it looks like it was in spring. And we have the issue of informants or spies, whatever word you want. But it looks like they were looking at, and members of the FBI were looking at the Trump campaign much earlier. And that might account for, Richard, and I'm going to speak to Doug right now, the insurance policy that Strzok talked about. Go ahead, Doug. What is your take on everything we've heard so far?
Yeah, well, there's a very good reason why Peter Strzok didn't leak some of this, because there was nothing to leak. He didn't know that the media would cover it so well. I mean, 12-year-olds, Paul Manafort deals that we all knew about in Washington anyway. I would say, why wouldn't you recuse yourself? A person of integrity, if it was the other way around, if it was a pro-Republican in there, Andy McCabe, if your wife is getting $700,000, and you know that $500,000 of that money is coming from Terry McAuliffe, who was the 1996 Clinton re-election finance chairman. You know that money's coming from there. Why wouldn't you want to recuse yourself? This is a professional organization, the FBI. So it's really bad. There's one simple reason why they didn't recuse themselves. They thought Hillary was going to win.
Exactly.
Andrew McCabe thought he'd be the FBI director, and Peter Strzok was on the fast track to promotion as well. That's why they didn't expose any of it.
Okay, Lionel.
Can I say one thing?
Sure, because it's two against one. Richard, please jump in. Go ahead.
Just a quick thing on Ms. McCabe business. His wife was a Democratic candidate for a state Senate position in Virginia. She got help from the Democratic Party in Virginia. To turn this into Hillary Clinton money, again, is twisted. It's really kind of making facts up.
No,
and
it's,
people
it's
will keep doing
Terry
it because
McAuliffe,
it's handy.
You can't
it's just a
him
fiction.
From Clinton's.
Okay.
Gentlemen,
we're not going to resolve this. We're not going to resolve that particular issue on this program here. Let me go to Lionel. I'm not going to put words into anyone's mouth, and I can read someone's text messages. This is from Peter Strzok, and did Lisa Page and Peter Strzok actually do any work? I mean, how many times they message each other? But here's one of them. We will stop him. And it was directed at Trump. We will stop him. I think all of us would agree. You can call Trump an idiot, a fool, a buffoon. That's fine. But when you start reading these texts, it looks more like a plan to me. And I don't think that's twisted. Go ahead, Lionel.
Well, here is the question, too. Not only did they work, but these were putative lovers. Did they ever love? But that's for another show. Look, let's go for the big hit parade. Let's look at Mr. Mueller's track record. You got Manafort and Gates, predated, antedated Trump. Big deal, so what? Do whatever you want. Then you've got Flynn and Papadopoulos, who, get this, are indicted for lying. So your main witness pled guilty to lying. Now, I'm an ex-prosecutor, and there's nothing worse than call your first witness. You pled guilty to lying, yes, but you're not lying now. You're a witness. Then he indicts 13 bots, some imaginary Russians who they figured, well, they're not going to show up in court. Some did, and that came on the heels of the FBI trying to explain why they basically ignored protests and warnings of some kid who was about to shoot up a school. So you know what Mueller's got so far? That's it. That's the big nothing burger,
okay, well,
as we
for
say.
Me,
after
the,
all of this
okay,
talk,
but for,
nada.
Okay, anyone that's watched this program for the last 2 years knows that I think this is a delusion, this whole thing. But what I'm really more interested in, because of looking for collusion, they've actually found what I believe is true corruption in the FBI. And I think that's what's really interesting here. Richard, I mean, you have major figures over the last few months that have left the FBI, and it's all because of these investigations here. I mean, do you support a thorough investigation? I'm not saying I don't like special prosecutors, but I think there needs to be a cleaning of house here. There's just too much that has come out with the IG report that really casts a lot of doubt on the bias of the upper echelon of the FBI. And I think the American people have a right to know. Go ahead, Richard.
So I think a lot of these FBI officials who have left because they are nauseated that Donald Trump runs the government and looks like he wants to run the FBI like a mob boss. Look, his hero was Roy Cohn, who was basically a lawyer to the mob. And Roy Cohn was a fixer, and he thinks the Justice Department and the FBI should act as his personal fixers. And when they don't, he's offended. He's offended that Comey wouldn't drop it,
okay,
which
okay,
he asked to
but
do
Richard,
about Mike
but,
Flynn. And one final thing.
Go ahead.
Let me make one final point. You know, Doug said, well, the reason that Strzok didn't put the word out about Trump being subject to a counterintelligence investigation about Russian collusion is that nobody would be interested. Trump won by a handful of votes in Michigan and Wisconsin. Do you think that really nobody in those states would just kind of go, oh, whatever, Trump and the Russians, oh, forget it. No, heck no. That if they really wanted to take Trump down, he would have put the word out, and he didn't. That's what makes this whole thing so ridiculous, this notion of Strzok somehow trying to take Trump out.
Well, okay.
He could have, and he didn't.
Okay, but we don't know everything yet, Richard. Let me go to Doug, because the second volume of the IG report will be talking about that. But Doug, it seems to me, 1 minute before we go to the break here, I mean, I think we've learned enough so far, and we're going to learn a whole lot more, because a lot of people are going to start testifying in front of a Congress, is that there was some kind of collusion going on in the FBI from the evidence that we have now. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were no statements pro-Trump among these FBI people.
Good
Richard's
point.
Turning it around to make it sound like Trump is running the FBI. Look, we have the judicial branch, the legislative branch, the executive branch. We do not have the Justice Department branch. They're not independent. Nobody elected them. They come under the executive branch. They should be Donald Trump's Justice Department, not Obama's Justice Department. The American people elected Trump, not Clinton. Sorry.
Okay, but at the same time, you do have Jeff Sessions and you have Christopher Wray. They're being very tepid right here. And when we get back from the break, I want to talk about why those two characters are weighing in the way they are. Okay, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on the FBI and Russiagate.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let's go back to Lionel in New York. Lionel, the other character outside of Peter Strzok that I find very, very interesting, even kind of mysterious, is Rod Rosenstein. I mean, why hasn't he recused himself? Because he's actually a witness in all of this stuff, and he's overseeing the Mueller investigation. I find that to be very troubling. Go ahead, Lionel.
Because there's a sense of paralysis. They're not supposed, this is not supposed to happen. For the longest time, you know, we've used the term deep state or intel state or police state or whatever you want to call it, whatever you want to call this government within a government. But for years, they've run this with impunity. And by the way, this is not the front line, the rank and file FBI agents who are out there investigating bank robberies and federal phishing violations. Those are great people. Same thing for the DOJ. But this is the seventh floor, this notorious group. They don't know what's happening. They went into this cocksure, ready to go. They thought they were locked and loaded, that they were going to somehow bring apart or cause the dissolution of the House of Trump. And not one, think about this, not one thing has ever materialized so far. And by the way, let me add on to this, the whole Russian collusion thing. Apparently, the extent of the evil machinations of the Russian enterprise is Facebook ads. So far, everything has collapsed and there has been a sense of paralysis. And what I suspect is they told everybody, nobody move, nobody recuse, this will somehow go away. This cannot be happening. It's learned helplessness, it's paralysis. But well, something tells me he'll be getting his marching orders, but without his say-so.
Well, it seems to me, let me go to Richard here, this is the ultimate boomerang effect here. We wouldn't have found out about any of these things unless they believed that there was collusion with the Russians. I mean, it's all coming back to them and all the characters that were involved in it. I want to stay with Rod Rosenstein, Richard. I mean, how do you explain that? I mean, he's in the middle of all of these things. He signed one of these FISA warrants against Carter Page. I mean, and he wrote the recommendation letter to fire Comey. I mean, he's got his fingertips on all kinds of things here. Should he be someone that's calling the shots? Go ahead.
So Rosenstein, yes, he did sign the FISA warrant, as did predecessors of his, and it was approved by one judge after another, after another, after another, all of whom were Republican appointees. So this notion that somehow this is this Democratic cabal is
a
joke.
But Richard,
conflicted.
You brought up the dossier, and they were less than transparent on who paid for the dossier and who put it together. So, we can mince our words right here, but my point Rod Rosenstein. I mean, he's involved in many elements of this. Should he recuse himself? Because I don't think he's an honest broker. Go ahead, Richard.
He's really only involved in one element, and as a fact witness, which is what Comey said to him and what the predicate was for that letter that he sent to the president, right? This investigation, Peter, is going to look at ways in which the Russians tried to affect the outcome of this campaign and money laundering and bank fraud and any number of different things. Okay. That little piece of Rosenstein's is going to be next to nothing.
Okay. I think the Russian meddling in the American 2016 election is going to be a very, very thin volume, if anything. But Richard, after 2 years and after that orgy of leaks at the beginning of the administration, you'd think someone would cough it up by now, but they haven't here. Okay.
Well, here's what I think.
Go ahead,
Richard. It's miraculous. Let me do one final question.
Sure.
I think it's miraculous, frankly, that the Mueller team does not leak. And these 13 angry Democrats that Trump talks about, Donald Trump contributed more to Democrats than all of those 13 working for Mueller put together. So it's his way of deflecting. I get it. But it's miraculous that you list Sessions and Jared and Roger Stone, all these people that forgot their meetings or discussions with Russians. It's a little bit more than a coincidence, don't you think?
I believe actually Roger Stone in is meeting with this really weird character that wants Trump's money, which, I mean, if this guy is a paid FBI informant that was recruited from the CIA, then they have some real personnel problems over at the FBI, believe me. Okay, fine. That's an interesting point. Doug, I want to go back to Christopher Wray and Sessions, because I think this is also quite fascinating here. Here we have oversight committees in Congress. You know, I mean, they're going to put out subpoenas. They're going to put people in contempt. I mean, they want the frickin' documents, okay? And they are very slow walking it. How do you explain that? Because, and I say this in a very colloquial way and not in a very narrow way, this is the Trump DOJ. This is the Trump FBI. How do you explain it, Doug? Go ahead.
Well, they're slow walking it because they know the whole world can change in 24 hours and they don't want this information out. You can see why Rod Rosenstein, why he threatened, that was chilling to me, threatened his own oversight committee. What has happened to the U.S. Constitution? I just want to revert back to this Russian thing because it's so incredible to me. You're telling me $200,000 worth of Facebook ads through the election to Hillary Clinton and a $500,000 fee for a speech to Bill Clinton that people could see on YouTube free of charge didn't throw the election. But I think Rod Rosenstein's chilling threat to the Oversight Committee should scare us a little bit about what's happening to this post-constitutional drift we're in this country. I think it's sad, okay. Dangerous.
And Doug, I'm really glad you brought that up. And I think all of us have our own opinion, and some of them are very at odds. But I think you mentioned a point that I think we all should really care about. And I'd like to go back to Richard on this, because I'm really, and I've been saying this for a very long time, I'm very worried about institutional erosion here and the confidence the public has in those institutions. And as things stand right now, Richard, it doesn't look great for the FBI in what we've learned so far. And we're going to learn a whole lot more. And I love how the FBI loves to use the word candor for telling the truth. I hope Peter Strzok will give candor when he's talking, because I think he's got a lot to explain. I mean, I went through a political article. I mean, all of the things he said. I mean, of course, it can be bluster, impress his girlfriend, but, you know, there's a lot of substance there. Go ahead, Richard. About the institutions, we need to protect them.
Yeah. I mean, again, Strzok said bad things about Bernie Sanders, about Eric Holder, about Chelsea Clinton. So somehow or other, obviously, we're putting the spotlight on what he said about Trump. Look, I think that James Comey damaged
president.
The FBI.
I'm glad you brought it up.
He damaged the FBI twice. He twice by giving that press conference, which he had no authority to do,
absolutely,
and by issuing that letter
at
the end of October. So I think he has damaged the FBI. But these people who work in the Justice Department swear allegiance to the United States of America, not allegiance to Donald Trump. You know, Doug says, oh, it's the Trump Justice Department. These people owe allegiance to the United States of America, to us, not to Trump. And therefore, and they can't turn a blind eye.
Okay.
And the problem with what the House is trying to do is they're trying to get documents so they can walk them over to the White House and say, okay, Donald, this is what they have against you. Be careful.
But
that's
Richard,
not right.
But Richard, at the same time, in the IG report, you have one of these high officials in the FBI making reference to Hillary Clinton as president. So, I mean, everything you just said can be turned on its head, okay? They were referring to her as the president before the election, okay?
And
I want to get equal
and
time.
And why in the world did they not disclose this counterintelligence investigation? That's the thing that's so twisted, Peter.
If they really cared about the country and not the candidate or against a candidate, they should have informed the Trump campaign that some of your folks are talking to people that we're worried about. I think that could have been done. That would have been their job, okay? That would have been the protocol. But they didn't do it. Again, that casts suspicion. Lionel, you're remarkably quiet. Jump in.
Oh, I don't want to interrupt this, but I hate to dispel all this. Peter, with all due respect, and
sure,
to Richard, I'm sure you're a fine, fine man.
He is.
Who is a slave to the facts.
He's a good man.
But this is
about
one thing.
He's my friend, so don't be
careful. And he's our friend, and he's a friend of truth.
Thank you.
That notwithstanding. Peter, this is about one thing only. It's not about justice. It's not about the FBI. It's not about anything. It's about this hatred of Trump. They hate Trump. They hate. It's the opposite of a fetish. It's Trump derangement syndrome. It's all about how did he win? He can't win. And we will do everything in our power, using every machination available, to try to extricate, claw back, undo, recreate, go back through time bandits, do anything, because Trump cannot be president. And people, not you, Richard, but people somehow that sound somewhat like you, wake up every morning and they say, this can't be. And that's it. And it's nothing to do with the Constitution, nothing to do with fruit of the poisonous tree, nothing to do with Mueller, justice, none of that. It's about the fact that they hate him and he could not have won. And everything that they tried, including that rancid candidate of theirs who lost a rigged election, she blew it.
Okay.
And they haven't figured this out.
But Lionel,
they need grief
counseling. I think we
all need help.
We all agree on this program that every individual can have bias, okay? You can have, you know, you like chocolate milkshakes opposed to vanilla. Okay, you have a bias towards one.
This isn't bias.
Let me finish. Let me go to Doug here. But these are officers that swear an oath to the Constitution. And I think that all of us are kind of close in age. You know, I remember the FBI TV series. Remember what kind of guys they were? They were the straight guys, okay? Straight up. Okay. By the way, J. Edgar Hoover read every single script.
A Quinn Martin production.
Did you know that J. Edgar Hoover read the scripts? So, you know, he was that rigorous about it.
No.
So he created a lot of mythology there. But on a serious note, Doug, I mean, it's a kind of a counter to Lionel. Of course, you can have a bias. But it doesn't mean you can break the law. And that's the difference. Okay, that's what I'm worried about. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, I was a friend of Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. and miss him. He was an interesting person who starred in the FBI. Yeah, I'd like to know where's the pro-Trump text
bias,
in the FBI? A little balance here. Where's some pro-Trump people that serve on the Mueller committee? It seems to me that this is going to be portrayed as a partisan witch hunt because that's what it is. And they won't. There's no attempt to bring any balance to it or any facts to it. And they're pursuing 12-year-old deals that Manafort made. Hey, I'm not in the FBI, but I know about Manafort deals that were 12 years old. This is how desperate it's become in order to try to get some indictments. I think it's pretty pathetic at this point,
right.
And it's good for us to know the truth.
Okay, that's what we all want on this panel and our viewers. We want the truth. So let's continue down the path. I'm interested in what Mr. Strzok will have to say. Many thanks to my guests in Washington and in New York. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk Rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.